you know, through fossil fuel burning, we emit more CO2 each year than all the volcanoes on Earth combined. We fix as much nitrogen for agricultural purposes as the Earth does. We are not outside of the sphere of nature. We are a dominant component of it.
That's Andrew Knoll, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Acclaimed geologist Andrew H. Knoll is the Fisher Professor of Natural History at Harvard University. Professor Knoll's research focuses on the early evolution of life, Earth's environmental history, and the interconnections between the two. He's conducted field research on five continents and for two decades served on the science team for NASA's MER mission to Mars. He joins us to talk about his latest book, A Brief History of Earth, 4 billion years in 8 chapters. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dan.
Before we dip into this book for some specific information, describe this book for us. What are readers going to find here?
Well, this is really my attempt to explain to the general public the long history of our planet that brought us to the current moment in time. And in many ways, the reason for doing that is that by understanding the long history that produced the physical and biological Earth around us, we'll better appreciate the fragility of our moment in the 21st century.
How is this book organized? How do you lay out the history of the planet?
Well, it is a brief book, as the title suggests. And so one really has to focus on the truly major events in the history of our planet that brought us to the world we know. And so in the first instance, I ask, how do we account for the makeup of the world? That is the chemistry of the Earth and the physical organization of the Earth. So that really takes us ultimately back to the Big Bang and the formation of the Earth. After that, I ask more about the physical makeup of the Earth. You know, how do we understand ocean basins, mountains, and by that token, how do we understand volcanoes and earthquakes? And so that takes us into sort of the inner physical workings of our planet that we experience in various ways. Then the next big thing is life. You know, how did Earth come to be a biological planet and how has it been sustained for 4 billion years as such? And then beyond that, for the first billion or more years of life's history, there was no oxygen on our planet. You and I would have lasted maybe a few minutes on the early Earth. So how can we understand how we came to be a planet with an atmosphere containing oxygen and therefore all sorts of new evolutionary possibilities? And from there we go to animals, which arrive fairly late in the evolutionary day, about 85% of the way through the history of the planet, to the greening of the continents. How did land plants get on land and transform it in a way that made many other types of land life possible? Catastrophic Earth. We know that there have been a series of mass extinctions in our planet's history, and how can we understand them and their consequences? And then that really leads to the final chapter, which is human Earth, in which I try to demonstrate just how pervasive the human footprint on our planet has become and how that pervasive footprint is changing both Earth and the life it supports.
Well, obviously, there's more here than we can talk about as you've condensed 4 billion years into just 8 chapters in telling the history of our planet. But one of the things I want to talk a little bit more about is those extinctions which have taken place on the planet, because when you consider all of those, the Earth has not been the most stable place to live.
Well, that's right. And that's one of the things we learn from the fossil record, that there are 5 moments in time over the last 500 million years when very rapidly a majority of all species on Earth just disappeared. The largest one took place about 252 million years ago. And if you look at the record of that extinction in the rocks, it's really pretty remarkable because you're climbing up through these rocks and they're full of fossils of the sea life of the time. And then you get to a point where you could put a knife blade, and above that point, you never see any of those species again. The earth just, you know, even the rock record of it just seems very quiet. And so that has happened five times. And as you suggest through your question, that is a context for understanding how humans are changing the planet in the 21st century.
One of the things we know is a problem in our present time is too much CO2. But you point out in the book that throughout the life of the planet, sometimes we've had too much and sometimes not enough.
Well, that's right. One of the things that is important about CO2 in the atmosphere is that it's what's called a greenhouse gas, which actually helps the Earth to retain heat that comes from the sun. And because of that greenhouse capacity, Earth has been habitable for 4 billion years. So we need greenhouse gases. But like many other things that we know in life, a little bit is very good. A lot can be catastrophic. In fact, the major extinction I talked about 252 million years ago resulted from a rapid increase in carbon dioxide associated with volcanism a million times larger than anything ever experienced by humans. The sobering fact is that we may actually be increasing CO2 through human activities more rapidly now than what happened 252 million years ago.
And I want to talk about that more in just a moment. One of the things I know has been a subject of your research for a long time, and you address in the book, is that there's an interplay going on between the physical and biological Earth and how they influence each other. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, when I was a student long ago, I became interested in both biology and earth sciences. And I think it's fair to say that my professors thought I should choose one and leave the other behind. But in perhaps the only real insight I ever had, I was sitting in my dorm room one night and I realized that in many ways, earth science and life science are two different sides of the same coin. So as a paleontologist, I know I can't understand the history of life without being able to place it in the context of Earth's environmental history. And by the same token, I can't explain Earth's environmental history without understanding various evolutionary innovations in life that have, you know, just again, changed the nature of the conversation between Earth and life. So yeah, that's a key point for, I think, just about any kind of thinking we want to do as a society concerning 21st century environmental change.
Well, that brings me back to our current situation because we are part of the biology of the planet. And even though we've been here for just a very, very small amount of time when you consider the whole history of the planet, the impact of humans has been alarmingly significant.
It's astonishing. You know, most of the fossil fuels ever burned by humans have actually been burned since World War II. So it's not just that, you know, humans in the sense of having societies have had an impact, which they have for, you know, as long as there have been humans on this planet. But in our own lifetimes, the rate at which we're changing the world has accelerated dramatically. You know, I've commonly talked to people who I characterize as having the little old me complex. That is, they can't imagine that humans can have an influence on the planet that matches the influences of volcanoes and, you know, seafloor spreading, all this sort of thing. But in fact, you know, through fossil fuel burning, we emit more CO2 each year than all the volcanoes on Earth combined. We fix as much nitrogen for agricultural purposes as the Earth does. We are not outside of the sphere of nature. We are a dominant component of it.
There have been at least five major extinction events in the history of our planet. And I'm curious what you think about where we are in the life of the planet now. Are we, because of the actions of humans, heading into a sixth extinction event. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, without question, human activities are whittling away at the species diversity of the planet. Now, most of the impact of humans on natural plant, animal, and microbial populations over the last 100 years has been through changes in land use and habitat destruction, pollution, invasive species, over-exploitation, that kind of thing. And those aren't stopping, but they are now increasingly playing out in a planet that is actually changing physically. It's not just a hypothesis that the Earth is warming. We can measure it. We can see how rainfall is changing. And that creates real dilemmas in terms of vouchsafing species diversity for the future. So I don't necessarily envision us in the 21st century having the depth of extinction that occurred when a big meteorite hit the planet and killed the dinosaurs and all sorts of less evocative creatures. But I think that the extinctions, by the time my grandchildren grow up, will be such that geologists in the future would mark this moment in time as an important moment of biological change.
So as you've looked at the history of our planet and these 4 billion years that you address in the book, what does that tell you about the future of our planet?
Well, I think that without question that if we keep on doing what we are doing now, the planet is going to change in ways that, by and large, will impose a penalty on most people around the world. And I think what I take heart in is that, unlike the extinctions of the past, you know, large meteors, massive volcanism, things like this, since we are the perpetrators here, we can actually choose to do something about it. And in the last chapter of my book, I do sort of exhort readers to take their responsibility as planetary citizens seriously. And if enough of us do that, I think we can at least minimize the damage that we're doing.
So what are some of the things that we can do to minimize that damage?
Well, that's a good question. And there are different answers for different kind of entities. So I think at the level of, you know, technological innovation, we know that there are mechanisms by which CO2 can be scrubbed from air. At the moment, those are expensive and can't be done on scale, but that's one possible way of ameliorating human change. We also are increasingly moving to a world where power is going to be generated by alternative power sources that don't involve fossil fuels. And part and parcel of making that work on a large scale is getting ever better batteries. So there's another place where innovation can work. And then there are the things that we can all do in our daily lives. If we can do everything from, you know, make sure our homes are insulated, to maybe next time you buy an automobile, get a hybrid, to buying, you know, your food more locally, and at least understanding that different sources of protein carry different carbon taxation tabs, if you will, for them. So I think, importantly, we can all do small things that will help, and there is the scope for people also to do large things. I think it just takes, you know, a collective will.
So we've just been able to touch upon what's in this brief history of Earth. What do you hope that readers will ultimately take away from the book?
Well, I think two things. One is, I hope that people will see the world around them with new eyes and to appreciate that not only does our planet record its own history in the rock record, but that we can actually see and understand our present world, both physical and biological, as the outcome of that long history. And then the other thing I hope people will take from it is, as I said earlier, to realize the fragility and importance of our own moment in time, the one moment in time where, as sentient humans, we can actually do something to configure the future.
The book is A Brief History of Earth, 4 billion years in 8 chapters by Andrew H. Knoll. Andrew, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Dan.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes, and you'll also find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.